理课堂听 class.com。
高等学校英语专业八级考试指南，由上海外语音像出版社录制出版。第三课，
Sample Test 8 Part 1 Listening Comprehension Section A Mini Lecture In this section you will hear a mini lecture. You will hear the lecture once only. While listening, take notes on the important points. Your notes will not be marked, but you will need them to complete a gap-filling task on Answer Sheet 1 after the mini lecture. Use the blank sheet for note-taking.Now listen to the mini-lecture.
Multinational Corporations. A multinational corporation, MNC, has industrial and commercial organizations in foreign countries. Manufacturing plants are established abroad in conjunction with supporting marketing systems. Multinational investment has a long history. In the early years of this century, European companies realized that their own home markets were small.Just as the Americans went west in the 1800s, European companies like Nestle, Unilever, and Royal Dutch Shell went overseas for new markets and became MNCs well before World War II. United States companies, which have a large home market of over 218 million people, had other incentives to multinationalize. Establishment of an MNC was a way to generate income from diversified sources, thereby spreading recession risks.It was a way to maximize return on investments, and it was a way to benefit from cheaper labor abroad. The formation of the European Economic Community, EEC, in 1958 spurred the growth of MNCs, especially the American ones. The EEC established import duty-free associations of countries, thus creating vast markets.This meant that one Western European plant of a United States MNC could sell its products within the EEC to a market of 200 million people without running into customs duties between countries. United States multinational growth in Europe was soon followed by the establishment of United States bank branches. How multinational can a corporation get? Some companies, like Nestle of Switzerland, make over 90% of their sales on exports and manufactured goods abroad.Today, the large MNCs control from 50 to 200 foreign subsidiaries with 30 to 90% of their sales on exports and foreign-produced goods. In 1973, some experts estimated an annual turnover of $600 billion for all MNCs combined. These MNCs owned over 80,000 subsidiaries worldwide. At that time, the annual growth rate of MNC sales was estimated at around 10%, well above the average gross national product growth of many nations. A favorable aspect about MNCs is that they create jobs in foreign countries. They also contribute to innovation or creation of new products and technology. But when innovation levels off and local technology reaches a point of sufficiency, MNCs are sometimes considered to be no longer useful.At this point, MNCs run the risk of nationalization, which is the confiscation of a company's property, plant, equipment, etc., by a foreign government with or without adequate compensation. Successful MNCs eventually must learn how to interrelate their subsidiaries with the parent company, how to delegate decision-making authority, and how to develop satisfactory methods of control and supervision.Having entered the international arena, an MNC faces an awesome task. It must worry not only about how to overcome the communication barriers already mentioned, cultural differences, distance and environment, but also how to deal with the different legal and tax structures in the various countries. An MNC also has to cope with foreign currency so that it can protect its foreign assets. Some other problems an MNC has to consider are how to secure continued access to resources, how to deal with increased criticism and interference by foreign governments, and how to deal with labor laws and antitrust legislation both at home and abroad. In recent years, MNCs have come under heavy criticism. Domestically, they have been accused of exporting jobs, meaning that jobs are lost at home because the MNCs set up plants in other countries, sometimes exporting the products back home for consumption. Less developed countries, on the other hand, charge that for years they have been underpaid for their natural resources may be regarded as a challenge to national sovereignty. In other words, this viewpoint sees the MNC as capable of circumventing or subverting national objectives and policies. This obviously reflects the majority voting power of developing countries in the United Nations. Widely publicized reports of payoffs to government officials by MNCs and even interference in local politics have brought heavy pressure on MNCs to exercise greater care, police their tactics, and redefine their strategy. For example, Lockheed, an American aircraft corporation, was found to have bribed officials in Japan and Europe to gain large government purchase contracts. The case became one of the world's most notorious episodes in the 1970s.
Now you have 2 minutes to check your notes, and then complete the gap-filling task on answer sheet 1 in 10 minutes. In sections B and C, you will hear everything once only. Listen carefully and then answer the questions that follow. Mark the correct answer to each question on your answer sheet. Section B. Interview. Questions 1 to 5 are based on an interview. At the end of the interview, you will be given 10 seconds to answer each of the following questions. Now listen to the interview.
Good evening. I'm Nancy Johnson. The guest on our radio talk this evening is Professor Wang Gungwu. Hello, Professor Wang.
Hello.
Professor Wang, you're now Professor Emeritus of Australian National University. And in your long academic career, you've worn many hats as tutor, lecturer, department head, dean, professor, and vice-chancellor. However, as I know, you are still very fond of your university days as a student.
That's right. That was in 1949. The university I went to was a brand new university then, and the only one in the country at that time. When I look back, it was an amazingly small university, and we knew everybody.
How did the students like you, for example, study then?
We did not study very hard because we did not have to. We didn't have all this fantastic competition that you have today. We were always made to feel that getting a first degree in the arts faculty was not preparation for a profession. It was a general education. We were not under any pressure to decide on our careers, and we had such a good time. We were left very much on our own and were encouraged to make things happen.
What do you see as the most striking difference in the present-day education since then?
University education has changed dramatically since those days. Things are very specialized today.
Yes, definitely so. And in your subsequent career experience as an educator and later administrator in various institutions of higher education in Asia and elsewhere, Professor Wang, you have repeatedly noted that one has to look at the development of education in one particular country in the broad context. What do you mean by that?
Well, the whole world has moved away from elite education in universities to meet the needs of mass education. And entering universities is no longer a privilege for the few. And universities today are more concerned with providing jobs for their graduates in a way that universities in our time never had to bother about. Therefore, the emphasis of university programs today is now on the practical and the utilitarian, rather than on a general education or on personal development.
Do you think that it is a welcome development?
Well, I personally regret this development, but the basic bachelor's education now has to cater to people who really need a piece of paper to find a decent job.
So you're concerned about this development?
Yes, I'm very much concerned. With technical changes, many of the things that you learn are technical skills which don't require you to become very well educated. Yet, if you can master those skills, you can get very good jobs. So, the technical institutions are going to be increasingly popular at the expense of traditional universities.
Professor Wang, let's look at a different issue. How do you comment on the current phenomenon that more and more universities admit students because of the fees they pay?
Well, once you accept students on financial grounds, one wonders whether you have to pass them as well. But this is the development in education that we have to contend with. Yet, if we are concerned about maintaining standards, what we can do is to concentrate on improving the quality of education.
Yes, you're right. A university is judged by the quality of education it offers. Professor Wang, let's turn to the future. What type of graduates, in your view, do universities of the future need to produce if they are to remain relevant?
I think their graduates must be able to shift from one profession to another because they are trained in a very independent way. If you can do that, you raise the level of the flexibility of the mind. Today's rapid changes in technology demand this adaptability, and you see, the best universities in the world are already trying to guarantee that their graduates will not only be technically trained, but can be that kind of people that can adapt to any changing situation.
I guess many people would agree with you on that point. University education should focus on both professional and personal intellectual development of students. But still, some might believe that there is a definite place for education in the broader sense. That's to say, in personal intellectual development.
No doubt about that. We need people who will think about the future, about the past, and also people who will think about society. If a society does not have philosophers or people who think about the value of life, it's a very sad society indeed.
Professor Wang, my last question. Do you see any common ground in education between your generation and the young generation now?
Adapting to new challenges is perhaps the true cornerstone of our generation's legacy to education. And the future of education in a country rests not so much in the construction of better buildings or labs, etc., but in the development of an ever-adaptable mind.
That's true. The essence of education is the education of the mind. Okay, thank you very much, Professor Wang, for talking to us on the show about the changing trends in education.
You are welcome. Section C, News Broadcast. Question 6 is based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 10 seconds to answer the question. Now listen to the news.
A half-day strike has been called in the Bangladesh capital, Dhaka, on Tuesday as part of the continuing anti-government protests. It will coincide with the meeting of donor countries in Dhaka to discuss an aid program worth nearly $2 billion. The strike was called by the main opposition Bangladesh Nationalist Party after it boycotted parliament on the first day of the new session.
Questions 7 and 8 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 20 seconds to answer the questions. Now listen to the news. The stock market in New York has drifted up and down after comments from the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, who said the recent falls on the world market could be salutary in the long term. The market rose by more than 100 points in the first hour of trading, but fell back after Mr. Greenspan's remarks. He told the Congressional Committee that the U.S. economy should not be threatened by market problems in the Southeast Asia, and said the economy was robust. Mr. Greenspan said that even after the recovery on Wall Street, many investors were less wealthy than they had been a week ago. But it was a salutary event. The head of the US Central Bank implied that there had been an excessive optimism about the future of share prices, and the recent decline might cool things down. If it hadn't been in Southeast Asia, something else would eventually have brought about the week's events. Mr. Greenspan traced the origins of the Asian crisis in some details. There'd been an explosion in the flow of money into the region, and this has helped fuel unsustainable property booms. Bank borrowed abroad and lent too much in the construction industry. When the project went sour, they had to meet their foreign currency borrowings with their own currencies devalued. Questions 9 and 10 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 20 seconds to answer the questions. Now listen to the news.
Intel, based in California, has gone from strength to strength since launching the world's first microprocessor, the brains inside a computer, a quarter of a century ago. More than 80% of computers now use Intel chips. This success, combined with the dominance of the software provided by Microsoft, has helped fuel the steep rise in the sale of personal computers seen over the past 10 years. Intel profits in the first 3 months of this year were more than $1.9 billion, compared with just under $900 million over the same period in 1996. Intel is putting much of this down to the success of the MMX, launched in January, and the enhanced version of the Pentium processor, and enabling better computer graphics and sound. But at the same time, Intel warned that revenue in the next 3 months would be flat, and competition is becoming much more fierce, and smaller rivals in the United States launch chips reckoned to be just as efficient but cheaper.
This is the end of listening comprehension. Please proceed to the next part. Sample Test 9. Part 1. Listening Comprehension. Section A. Mini Lecture. In this section you will hear a mini lecture. You will hear the lecture once only. While listening, take notes on the important points. Your notes will not be marked, but you will need them to complete a gap-filling task on Answer Sheet 1 after the mini lecture. Use the blank sheet for note-taking. Now listen to the mini-lecture. When you see a clever advertisement in a newspaper, do you say to yourself, "Ah, that's good, I'd like to have one of those," or do you say, "What lies are they telling this time? It can't be very good or they wouldn't have to advertise it so cleverly"? Both types of people exist. The first are optimists, the second pessimists and realists. Then, how should one deal with advertisements? An intelligent person will try to get as much help as he can from advertisements without allowing himself to be influenced against his own interests by them. To do this, he will find out something about the laws regulating advertising in the country in which he lives. Secondly, he will try to learn from experience and from books what one can believe in advertisements. When an article claims to be the best in the world, or to offer the best value for money in the country, is there any way of proving or disproving these claims? If there is not, they can simply be ignored. Advertising can be extremely useful if they are honest. If the advertisements are true and accurate, the customers will be satisfied and will probably buy from the same firm next time and advise their friends and acquaintances to do the same. They save a lot of time and trouble by putting sellers in touch with buyers in a quick and simple way. The dishonest advertiser hopes to sell his goods quickly and to make a large profit on them before the customer's reactions begin. He knows that no customers will buy from him a second time, that none will recommend his products to their friends. But there are also semi-dishonest advertisers who make claims for their products which they know perfectly well to be incapable of verification. If there was no advertising, fewer goods would be sold, so the cost of each article would be higher. The more you advertise, the more cheaply you can afford to sell your products. Advertising also encourages makers to improve their goods continually. As advertisers become more and more expert at their work, they appeal to all the human emotions in the effort to increase sales. Greed, jealousy, love of a bargain, fear of the disapproval of other people, fear of ill health, the desire to catch a husband, the desire to show off, and many others. But more and more consumers are also becoming suspicious of and resistant to high-powered advertising. This is producing, in highly sophisticated countries, a deliberately modest type of advertisement that is intended to disarm the suspicions of sophisticates by giving an impression of absolute sincerity, or even of deliberate understatement. Now you have 2 minutes to check your notes, and then complete the gap-filling task on answer sheet 1 in 10 minutes. In sections B and C, you will hear everything once only. Listen carefully and then answer the questions that follow. Mark the correct answer to each question on your answer sheet. Section B, conversation. Questions 1 to 5 are based on a conversation. At the end of the conversation, you will be given 10 seconds to answer each of the following questions. Now listen to the conversation.
I hope you don't mind me interrupting you, Mr. Bristow. Could you possibly spare me a few minutes?
Can't it wait till this afternoon, Keith?
Well, it's rather urgent.
I see. It may be better to deal with it now, then. I may not have time after lunch. I'm going out with a customer, and I might have to go on to his factory and not be back till late. Let's have it, then. What's the problem?
I've not been here very long, Mr. Bristow, so I may be making a fool of myself. Accountants can make mistakes, I know, like everyone else.
All right, Keith, get to the point.
It's this, Mr. Bristow. I've been checking through the accounts over the past 2 years, and I've reason to believe that someone may have been embezzling the firm's money. I can't prove the case yet in detail, but I think there's enough evidence for you to look into it.
That's a very serious charge, but go on.
What drew my attention to it was that Mr. Hammond, the works manager, was complaining the other day that he could never get hold of enough spare parts. As you know, Mr. Cross, the purchasing manager, has been off sick all this week, so Mr. Hammond asked me to check on the stocks on what had been ordered.
Quite right, yes.
I found we've been ordering far more spare parts than we need for a long time. When I showed Mr. Hammond the figure, he couldn't believe his eyes. He said we couldn't have been using such large quantities, and what's more, we've been paying well over the market price for them. I checked over the last 18 months and was able to discover what had been going on. The extra orders and higher prices were only for items we'd ordered from Holder and Bragg, but of course they're our main suppliers. I thought I might have made a mistake, but Mr. Hammond couldn't understand it. He said you might be able to throw light on it.
Can I see the figures? Yes, there's no doubt the orders seem excessive. Let's take gear wheels as an example. We can't have been paying that much for them. Of course, Cross may have overordered when he first came here 2 years ago, just to be on the safe side. But he can't have gone on doing that every month.
And even then, it doesn't explain the shortage, does it, Mr. Bristow? There are very few examples of these items in the store. Perhaps there is a logical explanation, but...
There may be, but I can't think of one. I can hardly believe it of Cross. But can there be any other explanation apart from the obvious one? And now that I think of it, someone said Cross was doing some part-time work as a consultant to a spare parts firm. If it was Holder and Bragg...
It may sound a bit presumptuous of me, Mr. Bristow, But what I still can't understand is how my predecessor, Mr. Lawton, didn't spot it. If he had been any good as an accountant, surely he would have realized that the figures were strange.
That's the piece I needed to fit the puzzle together. Lawton is Cross's brother-in-law. In fact, he recommended Cross to us. He must have been part of the swindle. Cross couldn't have got away with it otherwise.
I know Mr. Cross has been in poor health recently.
He may be ill, but that doesn't justify any of this. How long has he been off sick?
Since the beginning of the week. His secretary said he might be back tomorrow.
Well, if you're right, as I think you are, he'll feel a lot sicker when we get to the bottom of this affair. Well done, anyway. Cross may be back tomorrow. That'll be all for the moment. I'll have a call through to Hemming and Wood, the company lawyers.